From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. In this hour, more wonder.
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 Alone.
An endless journey.
Before my eye.
The velvet black.
Crystal. I felt so connected.
Wonder comes.
Breaks through.
Harsh.
The scale of the thing.
Alive.
Amazing.
Amazing.
I adjust the light.
The light.
Light. We turn.
That's it. Unique.
Like gods.
Beautiful.
Fun.
Huge.
I figured it out.
Wonder.
There is more to this world than meets the eye.
Then I just know.
Wonder.
For all of recorded human history, we've looked up to the heavens in awe. So let's begin by turning our eyes skyward with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson as he tells Steve Paulson about his first visit to New York City's Hayden Planetarium and how it led him to wonder and to science.
There's this odd room. It's round with a hemispherical ceiling and this creature-looking piece of hardware in the middle of the room, and the light's dim. You don't know what that thing is going to do. Is it going to come out and attack you? But then the splendorous night sky appears above your head. And I was born in the Bronx, New York, where I pretty much thought I'd seen all the stars visible. It was about 11 stars at night. And here were thousands. And in fact, I thought it was a hoax at first. I would later recognize that, of course, that was the real sky. And I was struck, starstruck, really, by it. And I would say that my path to become an astrophysicist wasn't even my choice. I was called by the universe, and that was my first true encounter with what I would call wonder.
Huh. How old were you when that happened?
I was 9.
That's astonishing. I mean, you now run the Hayden Planetarium.
Yeah.
But I mean, the fact that that would stay with – I mean, that that was such a powerful primal experience. And it, to some degree, I mean, you're suggesting that your life was kind of laid out in front of you from that moment on.
Yeah, I mean, had I not gone until 11, it probably still would have played out the same way. Here's what I wonder, though. Suppose I grew up on a farm and the actual night sky was there from birth. Would I ever have taken it for granted? I'd never seen the night sky. There it was. It slapped me in the face. And had I been born with it, it would have never slapped me. It would have just been the wallpaper.
What do you think happened during that experience when you were 9? Was it just how overwhelming it all was? How surprising?
Exactly. I think, and I've later done some research on this as director of the planetarium, and because we redesigned the entire facility a decade ago, and we thought long and hard about what kinds of exhibits are most influential on the visitor. And we leaned away from boxes that you walk up to and there's a handle and a lever and a button. And what we found, in order for an exhibit to make a completely indelible mark, it's got to be bigger than you are. You have to turn your head up and down, left and right, to see what's going on. And there are sounds and smells and you're transported.
Well, it takes us back then to your original question, which is suppose you'd grown up on a farm and the night sky was all around you without the city lights around. I mean, that is the experience of nature, isn't it? I mean, sort of feeling overwhelmed by it.
Yeah, I agree. But probably what would have happened is I would notice things that would change in the night sky. And that's, of course, what preoccupied the ancients. I probably still would have been enticed, but it would have happened in a different way. And it wouldn't have been a slap. It would have been a lure. A slow seduction.
Well, all these years later, you are now a very prominent astrophysicist.
Let me add, It took a couple of years between age 9 and 11 before I'd figure out that you could make a career out of that. Because at 9, you're not thinking, gee, I'll have a career. You know, it's just you just do it because it feels good.
Uh-huh.
And by age 11, if you were one of those adults who asked that annoying question, what do you want to be when you grow up? I had the answer. It was astrophysicist. And I'd give that answer, and it usually just ended the conversation right there. There was no comeback on that, but that was fine.
But, I mean, that really is amazing because, I mean, most 11-year-olds, if they do give an answer, they hardly are still doing that however many years later.
Yeah, I think what we don't appreciate as adults regarding kids is that they are persistently and perennially curious, and it's really forces of society that kind of squash that curiosity. I think it's primarily because that curiosity and wonder often ends in the destruction of something if you're a kid. What I try to do raising my kids is recognize that a consequence of their curiosity is the increase in disorder of the household. And provided that the disorder is done in the act of exploration, then I would be cleaning it up after them. And I'd do that willingly and lovingly rather than telling them to stop.
So how do you think we can inspire that sense of wonder in kids, specifically through science?
They already have the wonder. My worry is, how do we get that sense of wonder back in the adults? The kids are not the problem here. It's the adults run everything. The kids are already curious about the natural world, and left to themselves, they will explore it, period. So the real task of the adult is to get out of their way. You allow some level of disorder to descend, provided it is the consequence of the curiosity and wonder expressed by the child.
So what happens in school then? Because so many kids are turned off of science in elementary school.
Holding aside that they might have just simply had a bad teacher, the good student in class is the one who obeys the teacher, who is not disrupting. And that is like the opposite of curiosity and wonder. Curiosity and wonder is, I have this energy, it's gurgling within me, I've got to express it somehow. And I think this sit down, shut up, learn and take an exam is incommensurate with cosmic discovery.
So do you think this experience of wonder is above all an emotional response, or is it something else?
No, it's completely emotional, in my opinion. And it is the emotion that drives the inquiry. It is natural to wonder what's up in the sky. Take a look at what religions do. Typically, they put their gods in the sky.
Right.
They're in places where you look up in wonder. I used to think I was biased, that like the universe was cool. But no, I'm not biased. It's fundamentally cool. So I think I'm in the right business, actually, for wonder.
So, I mean, you just talked about how various civilizations have seen gods in the sky. I mean, do you think your sense of wonder through science is comparable to the religious experience of wonder?
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, I'm on some YouTube video making exactly that analogy in the following way. Back in the old days, there'd be pilgrimage to mountaintops because that's where the telescope was. It's a moving experience, just you, the telescope, it's dark, the stars are there, it is eerily quiet. The emotions that come over me and the words that I use to describe it have quite a bit of resonance with the words I've seen deeply religious people invoke when they've had religious experience. I speak of the majesty of the universe and the being overrun with emotion, just basking in the cosmic glory. There's vocabulary overlap there.
Well, one final question. You are now director of the Hayden Planetarium, not just the 9-year-old boy who went to his first planetarium show. What inspires wonder in you now?
I don't think about it that way. The way you ask that question implies that there's something I must appeal to continue to stoke the wonder that exists within me. And all I can say is that I don't think it's ever left. You know, I still catch snowflakes in my mouth as I walk down the street. I still see a puddle and ask myself, how high can I jump before I splash into it to see how much of a mess I can? I still do this. And I don't think I've ever grown up, really, which makes me annoying in some really grown-up meetings that happen in Washington or anywhere else, because I'm just really still having fun with the cosmos. And, you know, the certain agencies that say, well, this is serious. We have to have a serious conversation. Well, I'm sorry. I think the universe is hilarious. So no, I don't need anything to continue to stimulate it within me. There must be something in the chemistry of my blood that has it course through me every waking moment.
That's astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson talking with Steve Paulson. You can hear the uncut interview on our website, ttbook.org.
Seeing my first shooting star, knowing that it will be a long while before I see one again.
Camping on the beach, tall dunes, barrier island, the night sky strewn with stars. I could clearly see the bands of the Milky Way.
Super moon rise above the horizon.
watching the sunset over a pasture of bison. A lone bugle plays clear and poignant. We turn to see fields full of fireflies.
After the long heat of day, silver moonlight spills through the open window.
It's 3 a.m., Mongolian mountain range. Look up into the velvet black. If I stretch far enough, I could have plucked one of those stars right out of the sky.
When's the last time you were wonderstruck? For that matter, what is wonder? We asked social psychologist Jonathan Haidt to help us figure it out. And Strange Champs asked Haidt if he had personal reasons for studying awe.
A personal reason, well, only in that I am a complete awe junkie and I will do anything to experience these emotions. So
you said you're an awe junkie?
Yes.
Can you define that? What does that mean?
Well, I guess a junkie is somebody who needs his fix. When I was in my 20s and 30s, I needed frequent awe experiences, and I would travel around the world alone on 1 or 2 month trips. And I really enjoyed traveling alone. It kind of forces you to test yourself and have all these highs and lows. But it had a lot of peaks, and a lot of those peaks were, be it climbing a mountain or a tower or just finding a beautiful place. These were the greatest experiences of my life because they were just concentrated, you know, months of awe.
Jonathan, you're one of the few social psychologists who spent time studying awe and wonder, which are peak sensations, but what exactly are they?
Well, nobody really knows. I was asked to write a review paper on it a number of years ago with my friend and colleague Dacher Keltner. And we reviewed all the literature that we could find on awe in psychology, and that took about 10 minutes. And then we said, well, where have people written about awe and self-transcendence and wonder and all these positive, uplifting emotions? And the answer was mostly in aesthetics and literature and people who study the response that we have to beauty.
Are awe and wonder the same thing, or are they subtly different sensations?
I think the best way to think about this is as a family of emotions. But the key thing to keep in mind is that awe always includes an element of fear and dread in the face of gigantic, awesome power. So when you look at the awe experiences in the Old Testament, it's Moses in the burning bush. It's Saul on the road to Damascus. It's Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna gives him a third eye to see the universe as it is. And in all of these stories, we have a person who encounters the divine is blown away. He cannot process it. And then he comes out the other side changed. He's uplifted. He loses all of his old petty commitments and petty self. And this, I think, is why there is such interest in awe over the centuries and the millennia. But I think we moderns have lost sight of the fact that awe had this link to fear, terror, and dread. And beginning in the 18th century with the rise of aesthetic philosophers and Edmund Burke writing on the sublime, and we begin to focus now more on awe as, wow, isn't that beautiful? Especially in modern America, where awe has come to mean double plus good. That was really awesome.
You sound like you think this is not a good trend.
Yeah, it trivializes one of the most powerful and transformative human emotions.
I thought we were talking about experiences that might be a little terrifying, but also sublime and also ultimately uplifting, you know, experiences that might make us better people.
Right. So the way that my colleagues and I think about emotions, because emotions are not discrete. It's not like one moment you have a feeling of shame and the next moment you have a feeling of embarrassment and they're perfectly pure. Rather, there are all these different features or little switches that can be set. And so with the family of emotions related to awe, there are a number of these switches that you can look at. So one is something physically beautiful? Is there a display of virtue? Is there a feeling of threat or danger? The key features that Dacher Keltner and I figured, something has to be vast and there has to be a need for accommodation, which means that your existing mental structures can't fit it in. You have no existing way to process it. And this is why you have to grow in some way. You have to change. So when you see yet another beautiful lake, you've seen those before. It's beautiful, but there's no accommodation. But maybe the first time you see sort of a lake in a volcano or a bubbling volcano, well, that at least is something new.
We've talked about traveling, and, you know, I think a lot of us find those peak experiences when we travel. You know, you stand in front of the Grand Canyon or the Rocky Mountains, or you climb a 10,000-foot peak, and you feel awe and wonder. Why is it so much harder to feel when we're back home in our daily lives?
Well, again, it's the issue of awe experiences require vastness and a need for accommodation. You have to experience something that doesn't fit in your existing mental structures. And it's the actual change. You know, when you're contemplating, you're taking it in, and something in your mind is changing. And that, I think, is what is so deeply pleasurable. Maybe not for everyone, but for those who are awe junkies, I think that's what they're after. And, of course, you can't get that on your normal drive to work that you've done 1,000 times.
But on the other hand, I think a lot of us have had the experience of if you slow down in your daily life, you know, you're walking the dog at night and you suddenly really pay attention to the stars. There is wonder right there in our daily lives, isn't there?
Yes, that is true. And that is a point made by Buddhists and people who encourage mindfulness and contemplative practices. So I shouldn't say that it's not available, just that most of us tend to do it more when we're traveling, when our goal is to have experiences.
Are there other kinds of categories of experience that tend to produce wonder or awe?
Yes. So I tried to do research on responses to vastness and beauty and showing people all sorts of awe-inspiring videos and didn't get very far. I couldn't really induce it in the lab.
Wait, you actually brought people into the lab and tried to create an experience of wonder or awe?
Well, yeah. Haven't you ever seen a really good nature video? So what we did was we stitched together some footage of going up into outer space and vastness and then zooming down back to Earth and going down to the microscopic level and changing dimensions. And we all loved it, and the, you know, students loved it. They liked the video, but it didn't affect them in any way we could measure. As would say, you know, you climb a mountain, you get to the peak. And this, I think, explains why there's no real research on awe. It's just really hard to get it in the lab.
Hmm. Are some people more wired for wonder or awe than others? I mean, genetically?
Absolutely, yeah. Every human trait is variable. So Walt Whitman was described by one of his admirers, Dr. Buick. It was evident that these things, such as strolling through a city or through the forest, it was evident that these things gave him a pleasure far beyond what they gave to ordinary people. Until I knew the man, it had not occurred to me that anyone could derive so much absolute happiness from these things as he did. Perhaps no man who ever lived liked so many things and disliked so few as Walt Whitman. All natural objects seemed to have a charm for him. All sights and sounds seemed to please him. So here we have a person who just sees beauty everywhere, not just in nature, but in people, in current events. And boy, wouldn't it be great to live like that?
Hmm. Are there then particular psychological traits that make some people more inclined to experience wonder or awe?
Yes. The best established one, the one that we can be pretty confident on, is the trait called openness to experience. Some people just like to seek out novelty, variety, diversity, and other people like things structured, ordered, and predictable. People who just crave these experiences and will plan their vacations around getting these experiences, those people on average will be higher on openness to experience.
So for those of us who maybe are not hardwired to experience a great deal of awe or wonder, can we learn to?
That's an open question. I don't know of anyone who's studied it. I mean, in general, it's hard to make people more responsive to an emotion. I mean, there are efforts to teach compassion and things like that. But they often depend on people learning to do things consciously, like, okay, you know, when you look out at the sunset, think, where did this come from? And you can teach people to go through these procedures, but they're just not likely to do it.
You know, one thing that strikes me as we're talking is that most of these experiences, they're things that happen to you rather than things you
can plan.
You know, it's not something that can be deliberately called up. You can't say, okay, damn it, I'm going to experience some wonder right now.
That's right. And that's a very important point. What's unique about awe and wonder is that typically emotions happen to us to make us act in adaptive ways. So anger gets your body all ready to fight or flee. Guilt makes you want to apologize. So emotions make us want to do things. And that's one of the weird things about awe and wonder. They make us passive. We're frozen. We don't want to do anything. We just sit and stare. We don't move. Our eyes widen. And I think this makes sense if you think of these emotions as sort of cognitive emotions, emotions about taking in new ideas, new sensations. So basically, awe just makes us sit there and take in more. And when it's over, something has changed about us.
Can cynicism and irony coexist with awe and wonder?
Well, I think someone who is cynical and ironic is capable of experiencing awe and wonder, but I do think that they are opposed. Cynicism and irony is an attempt to put yourself over something, and awe and wonder are the opposite. They make you fade away.
We've been talking in almost exclusively secular terms, but aren't we really talking about how we experience the sacred?
Absolutely. And that's what got me interested in this, because I study morality. That's what I've always done. I couldn't avoid all these claims that feelings of awe and elevation, they are self-transcendent. That is, most emotions are about your concerns. If somebody makes a little comment that maybe reflects badly on you, you feel angry or ashamed or something. Many of our emotional experiences are so petty and self-serving, but we have this class of emotions that seems to make us forget our petty selves and care about others, care about higher truths. They seem to lift us up. So I think many contemplative practices, religious practices, are designed to foster these self-transcendent experiences. You know, I'm an atheist Jew, but when I travel, I love to go into Catholic churches. They know how to set the stage for an awe experience.
So if you were going to draft guidelines to help people feel more wonder in their day-to-day lives, what would you include?
Well, first, I would want to do years of research. But I think just from my own experience, I would offer this one piece of advice, which is arrange your life so that you're not so rushed. I mean, I'm very aware that I'm just rushing as fast as I can. I'm not stopping to smell the roses. I'm passing up opportunities for awe right and left. I think time pressure is the greatest killer of these experiences that there is.
That's Anne Strainchamps talking with social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. If you follow us on Facebook, and you should, you know that a few weeks ago we asked you to share a moment of wonder with us. We had our resident soundscapist make them even more wonderful. You'll hear them throughout this hour. Here now are a few more.
The depths of the Grand Canyon, staggered into the wall by the blast of energy that careens through ancient channels.
Working with people fighting to save their homes, filling sandbags and building levees, watching the water rise higher every day, consuming the landscape.
I wondered which contains more water, this lake or all the human bodies on Earth? And then I figured it out.
Saw my first red fox. Right in town.
My kayak, a windless sunrise on the St. Lawrence. Every few seconds, another deep breath. Whales and porpoises unseen. The ocean is breathing. The ocean is alive.
Huddled on a chairlift, steady snowfall. I realize the flakes are huge, unique, six-sided, crystalline, amazing.
Wonder comes contemplating how numbers, scale, geometry, map onto concrete reality.
Italy. Walked out of town into an enormous cloud of fireflies. Strode through their galaxies like gods.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Writer Heather McDougall says she was awash in wonder as a child. She found it mainly in nature. But as she grew up, wonder drifted away until she discovered Wunderkammern, Cabinets of Wonder. I asked her about stumbling upon these gateways to awe.
I first became interested in this whole thing. I was at a craft school, and somebody there had this book called Finders Keepers. It had these images in it that had been taken by Rosamund Purcell, who's a woman who goes in to the back rooms of museums and photographs the things she finds in the drawers there.
Ooh.
They were pictures of things that she had found in Peter the Great's Kunstkammern in Russia.
I think you're going to have to help us. What does Kunstkammern mean?
Okay, so you have Wunderkammern, which are cabinets of wonder, and Kunstkammern are basically the same thing, but they are based on man-made objects. They're art objects. Wunderkammern tend to be natural objects.
So she went and took pictures of Kunstkammern, of the things she found there in the...
Of the things she found in Peter the Great's collection, yes. And the one that just really blew my mind was this picture of a severed arm in a jar holding an eye socket. It had a sleeve on it with a lace cuff. And somebody had very carefully dressed this arm so that it would be pretty. But it's in this jar and it's holding an eye socket. So there's this kind of weird combination of beauty and horror. The person who created this was thinking in a way that I would never, ever have been able to imagine. It was about seeing something that was outside of my regular thought cycle. It wasn't about boyfriends. It wasn't about money. It wasn't about T-shirts. It wasn't about...
It wasn't about nature either.
Wasn't about nature either, yeah. And that's the thing. When you become an adult, it becomes harder to just step out into nature. I mean, you can, and it's still wonderful to go out there and see the showers of water coming off the branches when the bird takes off into flight. But it is easy to lose all that, particularly, I think, in this sort of age of irony we live in. There's very much of a tendency to kind of laugh stuff off and try not to care about things too much. And ultimately, if you take too much of that stance, if you don't care about things, if you don't make yourself more vulnerable, you can't experience wonder, I don't think.
Well, I wonder what this tells us about our sense of wonder. Is it how you encounter wonder that matters more? Is it the presentation?
Presentation is actually really important. My husband describes going to the British Museum. He went there because he was a coin collector, and they had this collection of coins, and he wanted to see it. And he had in his mind this vision of this, you know, big pot of coins just brimming and overflowing. I mean, they had pieces of eight, and they had doubloons, and they had all these sort of gold coins, and it was this treasure. And he gets there, and he walks into the coin room, and they've put the coins out on this grid filling this room. And each coin is in one section of the grid with a little label on it. And he says the whole wonder of the collection just died for him at that moment because they didn't allow it to be something that inspired thoughts. They had dissected it down to the point where there was no thoughts to have on it anymore. Looking at Wunderkammern, for example, if you look at the Wunderkammern from the 16 and 1700s, you know, this is a whole age of exploration when people are going out into this world that they didn't know and finding these places that were almost stupefyingly exotic and bringing back stuff they found and things they discovered. And then people were collecting them. In a sense, the collections were more of a private thing so that they could examine things in their own time. But in another sense, a lot of the collections grew to be these things that people would visit, and the people who owned the collections would make them as beautifully presented as possible, partly to increase the sense of wonder, because when you walk into a room where everything is ornate and all these incredible objects are on display, it takes your breath away.
It also diminishes each one, in a sense, if it's overwhelmed by the others.
In a sense, yeah, that's true. Although some of the displays were things like little drawers that you would pull out, and each thing would be nested in its own little compartment so that you were looking at each thing individually in its perfectly displayed way.
What kind of things would be in those drawers?
Narwhal horns were very sought after because they were believed to be unicorn horns.
Mm-hmm.
Fossils were very common. Red coral. And interestingly, as time went on, the Wunderkammer became this status thing. You would have to have certain things in it in order to be cool.
Those are examples of places to find wonder in the real world. Was your blog an attempt to find wonder in the virtual world? Was your blog a kind of Wunderkammer?
Absolutely. In the 1400s and 1500s, when people are going out and exploring these lands, now we don't do that. There isn't this sense that the world is out there for us to explore so much. And I think people are turning to the digital world, collecting things that you find on the web. You are creating a Wunderkammer. You're also creating taxonomies, which was a big part of the Wunderkammer, and where you collect all the birds in one corner of the room and all the shells in another corner of the room and all the things that look like sand in another part of the room, and quantifying things in terms that you find interesting. And the same thing is true with blogs.
You did quit blogging, at least for a while, a hiatus, I guess. The blog about wonder was no longer wonderful for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. There started being a point where Google was learning what I was looking for. Once that happened, I couldn't explore in the same way. It would give me results that it wanted me to see. So it was a little bit like some 1500s explorer going out and heading for the new world and the hand of God coming down and saying, no, you've always gone to Europe before, so we're going to head you off that way, and how can you get any exploring done if everything is smart?
So what do we do now? Is it a special challenge to look for wonder in our world?
I think it is. I stumbled across a reference to myself on the internet the other day, and they were talking about, I wish I was Heather McDougall because she's so open to the universe and she has this wonderful way of being delighted with everything at all times, kind of a thing. And ultimately, writing the blog for me was a way of combating depression. And, I think that's actually not uncommon right now. I think a lot of people are doing that. If you look at the explosion of the fantasy genre, if you look at Burning Man, you go out into this blank desert and you build this vast city, and people all come there with this openness, this sense of wanting to explore and wanting to be together in this safe environment. Or steampunk is another subgenre where people are creating a place to explore, creating a place to experiment, creating a place to deliberately create wonder. I think this is kind of what grown-ups are doing right now, approaching the world in a childlike way. You are naturally experiencing wonder.
And you speak from some knowledge there, don't you? You taught children, you have children, but you also teach children. So do you think we'll see more of it now? I mean, kids who have, we think at least, a natural sense of wonder, they're more perhaps open to wonder than adults are, and understand digital tools. Maybe there's a whole world of wonder opening
up. It's true. Yeah, I mean, you have these kids who are being raised on a diet of digital tools. And at the same time, they're also being raised on things like fantasy books. Kids' literature right now is more intense and more amazing than it's been for decades. I can't even imagine what things are going to be like in 10 years, because you have these kids who are being raised on a diet of wonder, who are being given the tools to create whatever the heck they want. I think we're raising kids who are going to go somewhere totally new and unique.
What's interesting is I was afraid you were going to say that we had lost our sense of wonder, that the modern world didn't have a place for it, that irony has destroyed it. But as you talk, it's clear you think there are lots of sources of wonder.
Oh, absolutely. And, actually, I want to make a distinction, because I think that irony has become mainstream now. It used to be that irony was the subculture and wonder was the mainstream. And that's done a flip, I think. The subcultures now, a lot of them are about wonder.
Maybe it's better for our culture that it not be the main thing, that it be a subculture that gives it more energy, more power, more hope.
There is this sense that wonder might win out.
You've talked about irony and cynicism and how they break down our sense of wonder. But if you had to argue the value of wonder, how would you do that?
I think about Hooke. He basically created a microscope and looked inside it and saw things swimming around. And if he hadn't stopped and thought to himself, what if there are things that are tinier than I can see? If he hadn't been wondering about things, he wouldn't have seen that other world, which is a whole other universe of study. And I think a lot of our really most creative and most innovative technologies came out of a sense of wonder.
Heather, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Heather McDougall's blog is called Cabinet of Wonders.
Butterflies.
That's it. Butterflies.
Every time my daughter looks into my eyes.
I got a kid's toy microscope when I was 11. One of the slides, a piece from a monarch's wing. I adjust the light.
That's it.
Before my eye, butterfly feathers.
The squeaking of fresh, untouched powder snow as your skis make contact in the alpine morning.
Any kind of synchronicity that could have never been planned makes me pause and wonder.
That's it.
Sitting on a porch with morning glories.
Anything less, I pause and wonder.
There are times I wonder, what's next? And then the sun is about to set, or the moon is about to rise, and then I just know.
That's it.
This is it.
This hour, we are all about wonder. Where do you find it? Producer Sarah Nix went looking for wonder just down the road.
While I was working on this show about wonder, people in Madison kept suggesting that I visit a place called the House on the Rock. It's a kind of cabinet of wonders, they said. It's awesome in its way. So one cold November Sunday, I drove out to Spring Green, Wisconsin, up the hill to the Rock, where a wealthy eccentric named Alex Jordan built a Flintstones meets Frank Lloyd Wright house. Inside, it feels a bit like Hugh Hefner on magic mushrooms. Jordan was a compulsive collector. There's a whole town dedicated to his dolls. His sprawl of maritime memorabilia surrounds a three-story model of a toothed whale battling a giant squid. In another room, hundreds of wooden carousel horses hang on the walls around an enormous carousel, which is hovered over by an army of mannequin angels with hand-painted wings. And then there are the calliopes. One after another, I walked through room-sized music machines. This one plays a ragtime tune. That one looks like a Prussian ballroom, plays a Viennese waltz. This one burns with Chinese lanterns. Drop in a quarter, and a mustachioed automaton picks up his mallets and beats the drum while figures all around him chime bells and toot flutes. I've been a self-proclaimed wonder junkie for years. I believe in wonder somehow. But for all that the House on the Rock is the American equivalent of a cabinet of curiosities, I didn't find much awe or wonder there. A friend says that awe is our response to something surprising, from which we want to move away, maybe to see it better, maybe to get some space, to stay safe. Whereas wonder compels us. We want to move toward it. Not whoa, but wow. For me, wonder merges mind and body. It's a sense of place in the overwhelming, unknowable universe. It's feeling fully present and connected to something large, complex, mysterious, and benevolent. There's no wonder at the House on the Rock because it's all a little mechanical and cramped. The pinging springs and hissing bellows aren't mysterious. The plethora of collections are just an eccentric imagination made manifest. But standing in front of an old cabinet-sized calliope, I realized it's not the objects of creation that are wonderful for me. It's the act of creation. Our capacity to take in the world, try to understand it, translate it, and share it. Wonder comes when I'm reminded that, unlikely as it is, we are somehow manifest as creative beings on a generous planet, with five senses and the consciousness to contain them all. From an unknowable source, the Big Bang, the gurgling primordial soup, the hand of some god, we get to be here and reflect on being here. And that is the wonder.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
2.5 hours of walking in downtown Tokyo. Coming through our doors, hugging my family, suddenly aware of the scale of the thing. Unchecked fires, towns washed away, while I had been walking.
Walking late last night. Leaves scuffle in the dark. Each breath, a pale white ghost. Stars burn and wheel in the winter sky. Light on an endless journey across space and time.
Lowering sun breaks through, catches the gnarled apple tree. The apples bend the red light to my eye.
My memories were of a wild, fathomless blue-gray-green ocean. But I saw that water can also be an embrace. An unknowable horizon can be a bright wonder.
Alone, the southern Alps of New Zealand. A waterfall, a moss-covered rock wall. I bury my face in the moss, and I just seem to float. In tune.
My first glimpse of the rainforest. That much life in one place.
More moments of wonder from you, our listeners. Can you make wonder? Create it deliberately? You decide. After listening to Anne Strangechamp's talk with internationally acclaimed artist Janet Cardiff about her sound art.
Well, Janet, I wanted to begin by asking you if you would walk us in to your 40-part motet, kind of be our virtual guide.
Well, quite often when you're walking into the piece of the motet, you start hearing the singers before you even enter the space. And so you're wondering, what is there? There's a choir in this room? When you walk into the room, there's stands with 40 speakers set up in an oval around the space. And as you walk up to one of them, each one is a separate singer. So you really get a sense that that speaker somehow has the spirit or the ghost of this particular singer. You know, the anthropomorphic sense of that speaker is an absent person. The 40-part motet is what I call a reworking of Thomas Tallis's Speminalium, which was a piece of music written in about 1573. It's an incredible 40-part harmony piece. And when I heard it on just a two-track system, I thought immediately that, oh, wouldn't this be beautiful as 40 different separate speakers? So a lot of technical innovation afterwards by my partner, George Burzmiller, and I, and we recorded a choir in England. We finally got the system played back onto 40 separate speakers. And it's quite fascinating to watch people because they sort of walk in quickly and all of a sudden they go into slow motion and their faces have this sense of, oh my goodness, what is this? And then they slowly walk into the center of the oval and they stand there. And then you hear the breath of the first choir going, ah, and then they start with Speminalium.
Gorgeous music to begin with, but the experience must be like being in the middle of Renaissance polyphony on steroids.
For me, it was a kind of interesting piece to do because I was very interested in having this up-to-date technology playing back a 16th century piece of music. You can follow the music as it goes from one choir to another and to another. You could hear it moving around in a sculptural way. I just love the feeling of sound coming from one side, then another crosses over you to another. And so all those sound waves hitting your body. It's put in effect.
People must cry.
Yeah, it's an interesting effect because you see people and they do burst out crying. And they, or they just sit there, and they sit there maybe for two versions through. And I remember watching a three-year-old conduct them, the whole choir, that which was wonderful too. And people lie on the floor. There might be 20 people in this space, but they're all staring into somewhere, whether it's an interior space in their minds.
You know, we're talking about wonder in this hour, and your work in this piece in particular seems to me to be all about creating an experience of wonder. Is that something you think about consciously when you're creating a piece?
I think wonderment in our work is something that we really concentrate because we love to experience it. And we make work so that we can feel it. And so many of our pieces have this sense, whether it's through trickery of technology or playfulness, it gives you a sense of, wow, how did they do that? Or all of a sudden you realize that you're in one space in your mind and in physical reality. You're all in different spaces and your mind kind of goes through this point where it can't concentrate. And so it goes into a state of wonderment, I think. And that is very important to me because I'm almost political in my views that the art that I want to create should be transcendent.
Is there something contradictory about setting out deliberately to try to manufacture wonder or an experience of wonder? Because I think of the experience of wonder as a kind of cosmic gift.
Well, I think there's so many different definitions of wonder, right? If it's the wonder that you get when you watch a magician, that's wonderment. But it's also, I was just in the Prado Museum in Madrid and looking at the Paradise of Earthly Delights by Hieronymus Bosch, and people were all standing around just going, how did someone create this world? So I think artists deliberately do that because we enjoy it. And I don't think wonderment, it comes naturally in the physical world, of course, but I think it's quite fine if it's manufactured.
We should talk about some of your other pieces. I mean, you've become really well known for the audio walks you've created all over the world. Tell me about the one in London's East End.
There's always kind of a bit of a narrative behind some of the audio walks. And the narrative behind this is that this woman is invisible and lost in London. She's walking around, but she's listening to a tape recording she did herself from years ago. But you also hear the character, the woman, which is my voice, giving you instructions as you move around, and she's listening to her past voice.
You can see the church steeple, scaffolding, graffiti on the wall, barbed wire, broken windows.
But then you start embroidering. You know, new stories come up, things happen, and after a while, honestly, I was just sitting in my office listening to this, and I got this strange feeling that I wasn't entirely sure where I was.
Yeah. I think people get very much in a trance when they do the pieces. And the reason I try to have them at the right place at the right time is that things sync up. Like I'll say, there's a lime green car parked across the street. And I knew that was a painter, Chris Ophelia's apartment right there. And I knew he has a lime green car, and it was quite often there. So then when people were doing it, Chris told me later, he'd looked out the window and he'd see people stop and just the look on their face was like, oh my God, how'd that car be there? And she knows it's there and this is the past. So I'm manufacturing these kinds of synchronicities. I see them as how you put poetry together. You put images of sound.
I'm curious about, you know, out of all of the media you can use, and you trained as a visual artist first, you use sound. Why is that? I mean, do you feel like sound takes us places, offers us something that the other senses don't?
Well, definitely. When I started working with sound, I just felt like, yes, it felt just right. You can still work with visuals. You create the visuals in the people's brains. For me, it's a medium that can go into people's minds in a way that is non-intellectual.
I imagine viewers must respond very differently. And of course, your work is has been seen in many different countries. You've got installations up in Sweden and Brazil and Canada, all over the place. Do you find that people respond differently? You know, some people are readier to play.
I definitely do. It's interesting you say that because we've had a lot of success in Germany. And Germans have a huge sense of curiosity. I think curiosity in the viewers, in the audience, is very important. We found that some pieces don't go over in America because there's such a short attention span. Hmm. People, when they go to museums, sometimes want the answer right away, or they want something right away. They don't want to wait 20 minutes for a piece to unfold itself and then have to think about it. Whereas a lot more, I think in Europe, people are much more open to that. And I shouldn't say that generally because we've had lots of work in America and the Americas. It's all been pretty successful. But I do notice when we have shows and there's New Yorkers coming in, you know, they're texting while they're listening to 40-part motet or something.
That's a challenge to the magician in you. You're just going to have to try harder to stun us.
This video will be an experiment. We're like those prisoners stuck in Plato's cave. We watch the flickering shadows on the screen. Try to align your movements with mine. Move your screen up to the left as I do.
Janet Cardiff is an installation, sound, and video artist. You can hear her uncut conversation with Anne Strangechamps on our website. That's ttbook.org.
Now stop and watch.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you missed part of this program, want to hear something again, or want to dig through more than 10 years of awesome TT Book episodes, visit us online at ttbook.org. You can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter, where we're sharing, well, all sorts of stuff. Check it out. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for More Wonder.
Let's continue.
A heap of thanks to those of you who shared your moments of wonder with us. To Mike Arnold, Cynthia Woodland, and Peter Sobel for voicing them. And to the inimitable Joe Hartke for making them sound, well, wondrous. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Sarah Nix, with the help of Anne Strangechamps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
Do that again.
PRI, Public Radio International.